Author and teacher John Lash is one of the foremost exponents of the power of myth to direct and shape an individual's life, as well as history itself. He is the co-founder and principal author of MetaHistory.org, a site dedicated to the Gnostic revival, the critique of belief systems, and the emergent of planetary mythology of Gaia. John has lectured on religious and spiritual issues for many years in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe, and at the Marian Institute Conference on the Origins of Christianity. He co-spoke with renowned religious scholar Elaine Pagels, author of the Gnostic Gospels, and John has just completed a major book on the indigenous wisdom of Europe, including suppressed pagan teachings on alien intrusion. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. John, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm fine.
Always a
delighted
pleasure
to be here.
What have you been up to since the last time you were on the program?
Well, I was on the program last April, I believe, March or April, talking with Art Bell, and pretty much spent a good part of the year working on my book, which is now finished. I finished it in December.
Is that the Seeker's Handbook, or is there another?
No,
one
this out? Is a new book coming out in October. The one that you just spoke of, regarding pagan wisdom in Europe and knowledge of extraterrestrial contact going back 2,000 years ago.
Now, what are you going to call this one?
Well, that's an interesting question, George. I'm having a kind of a debate right now, a lively debate with my publisher. We have a couple of titles that we're playing with. The title that I happen to like is The Once and Future Planet.
I like that.
Yeah, I like it, too.
It's
there was a book years ago, The Late Great Planet Earth. Don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, sure do.
But that was by Hal someone. And I think it was kind of an end-of-the-world book or something, wasn't it?
Wasn't it Hal Lindsey?
Yeah, Hal Lindsey, right. Anyway, The Once and Future Planet is about how our life was on Earth at one time in the distant past and how it could be again in the future. So there's quite a bit of scope to this book.
John, for us, I think, to get into our discussion tonight, you're going to have to tell us a little bit about the discovery of a couple ancient manuscripts in the 20th century, because they have a lot to do with what we're going to talk to you about tonight. And then we'll get into some of these categories of these extraterrestrial contact. But tell me a little bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls found in Israel, the Nag Hammadi found in Egypt, and what is our understanding of these manuscripts?
Well, that's an excellent question, George, and really a great place to begin, because as we go through these theories, one of the things we'll be looking at, of course, is what is the evidence supporting each of the different theories. And my premise, which I'm developing in my forthcoming book, is that both the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Gospels contain very significant evidence regarding alien contact. So I will try to very briefly just clarify what these texts are.
Okay.
First thing I want to say is that I love what you say about me digging around in ancient manuscripts in the AM, the Coast to Coast AM site, but, you know, I'm not really like an Indiana Jones digging around in caves. As a matter of fact, these two particular manuscripts, these two bodies of ancient knowledge are readily available to the public, and they have been now for over 10 years. Anyone can go into a well-stocked bookstore and buy these. The problem is that the nature of them still remains difficult for scholars to ascertain, because most scholars, and I think you'd appreciate this, most scholars who are studying these materials, and I'll describe their origin for you in just a minute, are not men and women who are used to talking about aliens and extraterrestrials.
Well, that's true. You're right.
And so it's a little spooky for them to find the evidence for this in these documents, which are ostensibly religious documents, you see.
How about the interpretation as well, John, of these documents? Because, you know, they're going on a basis in order to transcribe them. What if they're way off base? Is that possible?
Well, it could very well be possible. If you read any of the literature about the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, I'll just start with them. There's enormous range of debate within the experts about what they mean and how they apply to Christianity in particular. So there's still a long way to go before There is a clarity. There are about six or seven theories right now about what the Dead Sea Scrolls mean and how they originated. But the basic thing to understand about them is that they were found in caves near Jerusalem in 1947, in the summer and fall of 1947. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were written on vellum, which is animal skin, and they were written in ancient Hebrew. And they are basically the writings of a very small sect. They're written in Hebrew, and therefore they are of a Jewish background.
The Essenes, but, right?
No, not the Essenes. That's one of the theories. One of the theories is that they were written by the Essenes,
right.
But there are five other theories.
Ah, okay.
That's right. The Essenes is probably the one that most of your readers are familiar with, but it's not by any means the one that all scholars agree on. The most likely possibility is that these materials were written by a tiny splinter group of Jewish radicals called the Zadikim, Zaddikim. And if you would compare this group to something we would understand today, they would be more or less like the Waco, Texas Branch Davidians.
Okay.
Now, when we know that the Waco, Texas Branch Davidians consisted of how many people in their sect? A couple of hundred?
At least, yeah.
It was tiny. But it was a very powerful sect in the sense that the views that they held were very radical and very apocalyptic. And this same type of sect existed in ancient Israel, in ancient Palestine, 2,000 years ago, and they were the ones who produced these texts which were found in the caves near Jerusalem. That's the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the important thing about the scrolls that I don't think has reached the general public yet is that they don't really represent ancient Judaism as a whole, like mainstream Judaism.
Okay.
They represent really this ultra-radical, apocalyptic sect who are awaiting the end of the world and who expected a confrontation between light and darkness and expected, of course, you know, to triumph because they consider themselves to be the righteous ones.
What do most scholars say about the Dead Sea Scrolls in terms of their perception of what they say?
Well, in terms of their perception, again, George, that they're mixed. For instance, the biggest controversy about the Dead Sea Scrolls is to what degree they carry material and beliefs that were the origin of Christianity or not. Some scholars say, well, yes, indeed, look at the beliefs held by this tiny sect. They are the very same beliefs that were adopted by the early Christians, and therefore we have the origin of Christianity in this sect. I think there's a great deal of evidence for that view, but it's not the unanimous view.
Okay, and the Nag Hammadi, what's the significance there?
Right, the Nag Hammadi is a completely different kind of document. They were discovered a little earlier, actually, in Egypt, on the banks of the Nile, not in Israel, but in Egypt, and they were actually discovered in December of 1945. But I'll tell you something really fascinating. I think this is extremely fascinating and has to be more than a coincidence. They were found by an Arab in a jar, buried in a jar. There were 13 booklets, packets of books written on papyrus, and yet the significance of the Nag Hammadi material was not realized until 18 months later, which was the summer and the fall of 1947. So even though they were physically discovered earlier, the significance of them was realized at the very same moment that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And that was in the summer of 47, and I'm sure your readers will kind of get a buzz off the summer of 47.
Oh, yes, we're getting close to Roswell, New Mexico,
with
and some other
the Roswell incident, with the sighting, Kenneth Arnold's sighting. And the remarkable thing is that the world was initiated, you could say, in the summer of 1947 into a momentous phenomena, which we are still working out and still working through, which I call the ET-UFO phenomenon.
How do you tie in the findings of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the interpretations of the Nag Hammadi right around that period, with extraterrestrials? How's that tie in?
The remarkable thing is that in both of those documents, in different ways, UFO and ET contact is demonstrated. Both of those documents refer explicitly to alien contact in slightly different ways. The Dead Sea Scrolls from Israel tend to refer more to what we would call the hardware side. They contain descriptions of sightings. They describe sightings.
Close sightings?
Yes. Close sightings and close encounters.
All right,
with reptilian type entities.
Oh, you've got to tell me about this. This is in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Absolutely, my friend. Absolutely. And not only that, but hang on. In the other documents which come from Egypt, so we're talking Egypt, Israel here,
right,
which come from the Nile, the Nag Hammadi texts, just let me tell you a little about them.
Sure.
They are written on papyrus leaves, and those papyrus leaves were cut into pages and bound in books. And so the Nag Hammadi codices, as they're called, a codice is simply a Latin word for a book. They are the first examples that we have of actually bound and numbered books. The oldest existing books in the world are the Nag Hammadi codices. And they contain, written in the language called Coptic, explicit descriptions of face-to-face encounters with alien beings, abductions by night, and other close encounters such as we're familiar with today.
Why was this not so widely known, or at least broadcast to people?
Well, this hasn't been broadcast to people simply because, and I think this is more or less obvious, and you'll get a laugh out of it, scholars are spooked by this.
because
the experts, and I've met a few of them, experts in ancient Hebrew, experts in this weird language called Coptic that the Nag Hammadi materials are written in. These are men and women who have spent their whole life studying religion and the history of religion, and they are not, as professionals, accustomed to putting their imagination into the area where extraterrestrials come into play.
Do you think this information, John, was quashed because of so-called higher-ups in various religious foundations?
Well, that's very possible. Excuse me, I'm just letting the cat in the door.
All right, get the cat in. We don't want the cat to get lost, so if you've got to take a moment, go get her.
Sit at my feet here and advise me.
Okay.
There's a couple of ways to answer that. In the first place, I don't think today that there has been necessarily an explicit attempt to censor this material because of its ET content. Like I said, I think it's just something that scholars can't handle. It goes outside of their field of discipline and it spooks them. I mean, I swear to you, I've studied these materials, and especially the Nag Hammadi writings, for a very, very long time. It is so obvious and clear what they are talking about that you would have to put a blindfold on not to conclude that this is extraterrestrial contact. Yet no scholar has come out and admitted that.
All right, give us, if you can, for both the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi, give us an example of each, if you can, John, to give us a perspective of why some scholars aren't agreeing with this, and then those like you are.
Well, I'll give you an example from each set of documents.
Okay.
Now, remember, the Dead Sea Scrolls are the record of a Waco, Texas-like cult. And they are not a record of mainstream Judaism, of the beliefs of mainstream Judaism. They're really apocalyptic. And what does apocalypse mean? It means that this particular cult, called the Zadikim, were awaiting the end of the world in Palestine in 2,000 years ago. And their vision of the end of the world is what I call mystic and militaristic. They saw the end of the world as a mystical or supernatural event on the one hand, but they also saw it as a military event, as a war. They looked forward to the liberation of Palestine from Roman occupation. They wanted to see their cult triumph over the powers of the Roman Empire. And since they were a tiny little splinter cult consisting only of some thousands of people, a couple of thousand people living in the remote desert, they would not have been able to win this battle without supernatural assistance.
True.
So if that'll give you some idea of their mindset, you will find that in the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, in a set of documents called the Songs of the Sacrifice of the Sabbath, they describe what are called the Kedoshim. And the Kedoshim are heavenly angels who are going to come out of the sky in shining round chariots and assist this cult in overcoming the massive war machine of the Roman Empire.
My.
And if you would like, I'll just read you a couple of lines of this because
of the
impact of the direct material.
This is dramatic,
This is a eyewitness account from the Dead Sea Scrolls of the Kenoshim, or the heavenly angels, who are going to come and rescue them. They do not sit still, the glorious chariots, the shining wheels, the spirits of God. When they move, they do not turn aside. They go straight up. When they rise, the murmuring sound of God is heard, and there is an uproar of exultation. The murmuring sound of God's. And when they move, it is as if glorious wheels with the likeness of fire move in the sky. Around them is the likeness of electrum, a luminous substance, and they are gloriously multicolored. And there is a murmuring voice when they move, and they rise up wonderfully, and then they settle and stand still where they are.
That sounds exactly like a sighting.
It sounds exactly like a sighting. You know, we have evidence of course, millions and millions of sightings, and that evidence is vastly varied. But there is one thing that is absolutely consistent, is that this particular movement of the UFOs, which are shining, round, radiant, luminous vehicles, defy the laws of gravity, don't they? They move and they rise and they settle and they stop in ways that, for instance, jet planes cannot do.
And I'm going to tell you, John, that's a better description of a UFO sighting than most that we're getting in modern times.
It is indeed. It is. It's extremely clear. And so there's evidence, textual evidence at least, in ancient Hebrew from about 2,000 years ago of sightings of the vehicles, of the hardware.
I don't know how anyone could interpret it as anything but that.
Well, and not only that, but the whole mindset of this cult, the Zadokim, so resembles that. I would put it as a cross between the Waco group and Heaven's Gate. Remember the ones who committed suicide in Santa Fe Springs?
I sure do.
Very much their mindset, their vision of what was going to happen when the heavenly angels came in this war of light against darkness, very much resembles a blend between those two cults.
John, when we come back, let's talk about in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you made reference to reptilians. Then talk about an example from the Nag Hammadi, and then we'll get into these nine possible categories, theories of extraterrestrial contact tonight. I'm George Norrie, fascinating guest, John Lash, on Coast to Coast AM. February 24th, cutoff date now, the CD, the free CD, Perfect Possession, the Art Bell interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. That is the last day it will be available and given to you free when you subscribe to an After Dark newsletter. So call 1-888-727-5505 if you're interested. You can also go online. There's a link on coasttocoastam.com, safe and secure. You'll get the newsletter. That's 12 of them, one a month. But you'll also get the free CD, the collector's item, called Perfect Possession. John, the interpretation with the Dead Sea Scrolls and craft, that was fantastic. Now, you had mentioned reptilians. Where does it come up in the text?
Well, there are actually three places where one could look for that evidence in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the first place, some of your listeners may have heard of an ancient document which is not found in the Bible. It's often related to the biblical writings called the Books of Enoch. And these ancient books have been mentioned by many writers on UFOs. For instance, George C. Andrews refers to them a lot in his Extraterrestrial Friends and Foes. Other people have cited them because the Books of Enoch contain a description of what are called the Watchers, or the Nephilim. And these are widely considered to be some kind of fallen angels that may be, certainly ETs, that may be of a reptilian type. Well, copies of the Books of Enoch were found in the Dead Sea Caves. And scholars know that these books were tremendously important to this particular sect. So that is one of the sources okay. in the Dead Sea materials. The other one is a book called The Testament of Amram. And Amram is the name of the father of Moses.
Sure.
And in this Testament of Amram, it's just a fragment, as many of the things from the Dead Sea Scrolls are, not a complete document. But in the fragment, it describes rather explicitly an incident of a man who was confronted by two frightening beings. And it describes these beings as having a radiant or luminous quality, and yet being shiny as if they had a coat of mail, meaning a coat of armor. And, of course, there are various ways to read this. You could say that it was just talking about two people who are wearing coats of armor. But the problem with that is that in that time, the only people who wore coats of armor were the Romans.
That's right.
And the Romans were the sworn enemies of this sect. And they had a name for the Romans. They called them the Kittim. So if they had been referring to Roman soldiers, two Roman soldiers pinning this man down and confronting him, it would have been quite clear that they were humans and that they were Romans in armor. The text seems to indicate that the beings who confronted this man and threatened him and said that they were going to overpower him and that they could control whatever he did were of a supernatural kind, and that their skin was of a shiny or scaly nature. That's in the Testament of Amram.
You know, I've always wondered, John, if fallen angels were indeed extraterrestrials. And it slowly starts to make sense when you hear some of the things that you're saying, how they could interpret them to be that.
Indeed. Indeed, they could. And when we get to our nine theories coming up here soon, when we go over these nine categories of the ET theories, one of them, which I call biblical ufology, deals exactly with that equation, angels equals extraterrestrials.
Now, when you talked about the Nag Hammadi, you talk more in the terms of software, basically. They saw beings themselves. Tell me about that.
That's right. You will find in the Nag Hammadi, and there are only 52 documents, there are about 30 major documents and then about 20 small fragmentary documents. These are the ones that were written in this strange language called Coptic and discovered in Egypt, that they deal not with hardware. I have yet to find in the Nag Hammadi texts any indications or descriptions of hardware as remarkable as the one that we saw earlier. Rather, the people who wrote the Nag Hammadi materials, and we might touch on who they are here in a minute, seem to be of quite a different orientation than the Dead Sea sect. In the first place, they were not waiting for any kind of supernatural beings to come and save them. They were not an apocalyptic group, the people who wrote the Nag Hammadi text. They seem to have been much more concerned with observing the activities of that other apocalyptic group. And they were concerned with alien intrusion upon humanity as not a good thing. It was not something that they welcomed. It was something that they were warning us about.
Very concerned.
Yes. In fact, that is one of the striking differences. When you put these two ancient sets of documents side by side and compare them, you come up with some rather remarkable insight.
It's strange because on one, those with the Dead Sea Scrolls, they seem to be looking toward them for help and guidance. On the in Egypt, it was totally opposite.
It was totally opposite. And there is, in fact, not just hints or suggestions in the Egyptian material that these alien entities were not well inclined toward humanity, but there is quite an elaborate teaching. I would call it a body of teaching regarding the origin and nature of extraterrestrial contact, where they come from, what they're doing here, what their relationship to humanity is, what their methods are, how they operate. There's one text called the Second Apocalypse of James, which describes a direct first-hand encounter. There's a phrase in the Second Apocalypse of James, they abduct souls by night. So this to me is a very clear description of the typical UFO abduction when the subject is paralyzed or teleported out of their bed.
I've always wondered if some of these Egyptian statues, John, were portrayals of these entities, these beings.
That could very well be. There are certainly some of them that don't look human, and some of them that have a very, very odd, very odd look about them.
Did you, and we're going to move into these nine categories shortly, mm-hmm. did you do any investigating of Zachariah Sitchin's work and some of his similarities with some of this?
Extensively. In fact, Sitchin is the main exponent of one of the categories we're going to be discussing. And I have read all of Sitchin's stuff. I think there are, about 8-9 volumes?
And he keeps adding to them, too.
The Earth Chronicles, right. Yep. First he wrote the Earth Chronicles, and then he kind of completed them at 6 or 7 volumes, I think. And then he continued to write and elaborate his ideas. Now, Sitchin is a profound scholar, as you know.
Right.
This man is no charlatan. I mean, he can read several ancient languages. He can read the Dead Sea Scrolls in the original.
Not a lot of people can read that.
Not a lot of people can read that. The curious thing is, though, George, in my knowledge of Sitchin's work, and I may be mistaken, but he does not refer to these essential Egyptian materials. He does not refer to the Nag Hammadi materials.
You're right about that. He does not
refer to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
And then, of course, the Sumerian texts, which he uses quite a bit.
Actually, the most ancient written documents that survive in the world. You know, I often think that we have our high technology now. We have CD-ROMs and so forth, but we're beginning to be a little bit uncomfortable because we know that CD-ROMs can decay. And this electronic information that we have stored is extremely vulnerable,
sure.
Isn't it? Well, the Sumerian tablets were written on clay. They were imprinted in clay in a cuneiform language and baked. And they have survived for 3,800 years.
At least.
So I would like to know if a CD-ROM that we have on the desk today is going to be playable in 3,600 years.
Even if it was, we probably wouldn't have computers that it could play on.
Well, there you go. So we're very lucky that somebody invented the technology of these clay tablets.
Now, this question to you might be somewhat controversial in that it appears to me that what these people of the time period were witnessing were extraterrestrials coming down in mass. Could that then have been misconstrued as we talk about the gods and stories of God? Could they have confused real-life extraterrestrial events and just made them godlike?
Well, it's fairly certain to me that many of the descriptions of so-called gods in the Sumerian tablets and in the Dead Sea Scrolls are descriptions of extraterrestrials. Now, that doesn't exclude the possibility that there are some other kinds of gods, you know, some divine beings
right.
or supernatural beings may well exist. But the remarkable thing is that the textual evidence we have points very clearly to gods who are of an alien or extraterrestrial nature.
There are also just too many things that point toward extraterrestrial visitation. I keep thinking of the work in Abydos in Egypt, and clearly on those etchings, they've got what look like flying machines. There's one that I got to tell you looks like a modern day helicopter. I think, John, one of two things. Either there was visitation of extraterrestrials with incredible technology, or this planet was more advanced than a lot of us thought that, it might have been at the time, and something happened. Maybe civilizations had high technology, had flying machines, had vehicles, but maybe we blew ourselves up then.
Well, you know, it's very hard to tell at the distance in time that we are from the time when these documents are written. But there's a lot of evidence for the second point you're making there. You know, if we just switch momentarily to Asia, to India, there are also ancient documents in India which describe these Vimanas, they're called. And the Vimanas are very clearly flying vehicles which have extraordinary properties, more extraordinary than jet planes, and also have what we would call destructive or nuclear capacities, very clearly described. And there's no question that these Vimanas were developed by the ancient civilization of the Earth itself. So you're absolutely right. I think we have to consider both hypotheses side by side. Not only was there ancient contact, but we ourselves had an advanced technology.
I keep thinking if we annihilated, we as people on this planet, civilizations with atomic weaponry, and then 1,000, 2,000 years later, those people who had been offspring survivors over the generations, as they were trying to survive with technology gone and everything else, but some of them would remember stories handed down from father to son and all the way down. I think the stories would be pretty darn similar to some of the things that were picked up then 3,000 to 5,000 years ago.
It does seem to be the case, and you're absolutely right. Human memory, what I would call the species memory, is a pretty deep well.
They'd find a modern book, maybe written by you, and you know, it would make reference to flying machines of, and you know, and nuclear power, and they'd say, but you know, maybe they blew themselves up. I mean, that's very possible.
Well, you know, it would be a good thing for our species if we could remember the past experience and learn and not repeat the mistakes of our ancestors.
Good point. good point. Was there ever any reason or rationale why the visitations? Did the scrolls or the Hammadi ever make reference to why they came here?
Well, the very much so, and as I said again, the interesting thing about these two sets of documents, which were both discovered at the same time that the UFO phenomena, as we know it, was born, they give two different reasons why, and we are still debating those reasons. As you well know, because you treat the subject on a daily basis,
yes.
There's a group of people who believe that aliens, extraterrestrials, and UFO people are space brothers who have come to save us and could be our liberators, or they could have been our creators in the first place. They could have been the ones who manipulated our genetics and made us what we are. There's another group of people who say, no, the human race is a distinct species of its own, and these are intruders, and they're not benevolent space brothers. Both of these viewpoints are reflected in these materials.
Which one would you accept, if not both?
Well, I have to say that upon much reflection, I find that the Nag Hammadi material, which is can also be called the Gnostic material, because it was written by these Gnostic groups, seems to me to be the most deeply developed and the most profound in what they say about our relation to extraterrestrial beings. Now, they do not say, and I want to make this point very, very clear, the Nag Hammadi materials do not say that all the non-human or alien species that contact us are evil and predatory. They recognize the existence of other species beside the human species, some of whom can be our allies.
Mm-hmm.
But they warn about one particular predatory species. And my view is, well, one would be enough.
That's all you need. All
you need is one.
Is that the reptilian race?
They call them the Archons. They call them the Archons, and the Nag Hammadi materials explicitly describe the Archons as being of a draconic type, D-R-A-C-O-N-I-C. That's the word you find in the text. And, of course, draconic, dracon, means dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about an explicit description of a reptilian type.
Isn't that interesting, John, how the description of the devil is, because everyone makes him look kind of like a dragon. He's
indeed.
Yeah.
A dragon with wings, a
yep.
kind of bat-like dragon.
Yep, and horns.
Well, yeah, there's no question that the early Christians drew the figure of the devil from this information.
I think you're right. I mean, here we are then getting possibly visited by beings that, people then, because of their evil, I would assume, turn them into what we now consider to be the modern-day version of the devil.
Right, and that's not exactly the way to look upon these beings, because another thing that I would like to emphasize about the Gnostic materials is that they are very, very sophisticated. Their analysis and description of these entities is quite sophisticated and subtle. For instance, they do not come out and say necessarily that these Archons, as they call them, are evil. They could easily be made into an evil being, mm-hmm. be made to look evil. They simply say that they are actually beings from beyond the Earth. They belong to the planetary system that we inhabit. You know, the Earth is part of a planetary system. But as far as we know, and science tells us, the Earth is the only planet in the solar system which sustains life as we know it.
Did they say where they all went?
Yes, they did. They attribute the habitat, if I would use that word, they say that the habitat of these Archon beings is the planetary system that we inhabit. Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, in other words, they are entities who, by their nature, by their makeup, and by the technology they possess, are able to live and move within the solar system at large. We are not. We are a species who live in a kind of very precious laboratory
yes.
here on Earth.
We're in the bubble.
We're in this bubble. This blue bubble. And one of the reasons why I believe ET UFO encounters are so erratic is because when they come into our bubble, they can't really stay here. They don't really belong here.
Hold that thought right there, John. Back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And with our special guest tonight, John Lash, his website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Go ahead, take a look at some of the things he's been working on. This is an incredible story, and we'll be back with him now as we talk about the 9 theories, categories of extraterrestrial contact. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. John, I've got to tell you, too, you've got a wealth of knowledge.
Well, thank you.
Really appreciate it. Now that you've got these nine theories or categories, you say, mm-hmm. of extraterrestrial contact, let's go through each one. Take the entire hour for that. We'll take phone calls with you next hour.
Excellent.
And let's get a take, your opinion on these various aspects. Number one, you call the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, that I believe that is the name that is in use. It's not something I invented, but I found it in one of the current books on UFOs. And that is the one, probably, this is the theory that most of your listeners will be familiar with, and the one that gets a great deal of discussion on the airwaves in the United States. The essence of this theory is that there are aliens from a technologically advanced civilization who had made contact with the U.S. government and probably other governments in the world in 1947, if not a little earlier. And at that time, so this theory goes, these alien ET types cut a deal with the government, offering to give their advanced technology in exchange for the right to experiment on the population.
Nice trade, right?
Yeah, including both animals and people. So what proceeds then from this theory are the cattle mutilation phenomena, CIA mind control conspiracies, and all of the stuff which you frequently talk about, and Art Bell also frequently talks about, regarding a cover-up of government knowledge of UFOs. We're all very, very aware that that is more than a likelihood. And there are two ways to, as we go through each of these nine theories or categories, there are two ways to evaluate each one of them. One is, and we can talk about the authors or the main proponents of that theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, we can consider, well, what actually is the evidence that supports this
okay,
theory.
Okay, sure. And why cut a deal? Why not just do it? I mean, how can we stop them?
Well, this is, of course, a huge question, and the notion that such an important event in the evolution of humanity, the contact with another species, would be covered up and controlled by government agencies is more terrifying than the idea of contact itself, you
That's
know?
That's true.
I mean, most people, I think, who have considered and reflected on this hypothesis are aware that the greatest danger may come from our own government and rather than from the aliens who contacted the government. How to break through this? Well, do just what you do so frequently. Allow people to speak their minds, allow the witnesses to come forth, and get as much of the evidence as we can out there in the public domain. I mean, that is the one thing that is the best weapon against a conspiracy of silence in the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Some of those proponents that you talk about, we know, Timothy Good, David
right.
Icke, George Andrews,
yeah.
and then
right.
David Jacobs, of course, truly believes that there's something threatening and sinister going on here.
Well, yeah, it's interesting to see how the hypothesis has somewhat evolved. I mean, I recognize sort of two main aspects of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. One is, of course, the government CIA connection, cover-up, underground bases, and so forth. The other one is the question of an interbreeding program, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's one thing to say, and it's pretty sinister and scary to say that a covert government made an agreement with aliens to allow them to experiment on our species. Then Jacobs, of course, goes even further and says, well, it's not just experimentation. They're not just giving us medical exams, you know, to find out how we work. They actually have a very extensive interbreeding program, the object of which is to produce some sort of hybrid entity.
And what we don't know is whether it's to take back to their own planet for some reason or if they plan on having these hybrids take over this planet.
Well, very interesting question. Now, as you know, within this particular category, there are just hundreds of variations of, and hundreds of kinds of speculation. One of which is that this species, which has come here in 1947, possibly crashed at Roswell and so forth, is a dying species. I'm sure you're familiar with this idea that they are somehow in their own evolution on the down curve, and that possibly by interbreeding with us or genetically tapping into our gene base, our genome, they hope to save themselves. That's one possibility. If that were the case, then they wouldn't have the intention of coming in and replacing us in our own habitat.
Then using that old Twilight Zone movie to serve man, maybe they're using us as feed. You never know.
You never know. It's very, very spooky. In fact, we're starting here of these nine categories with the one that is not only the most well-known in terms of the American public, but also the one which has been reflected in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's been reflected in the science fiction medium for a long time, and usually with rather sinister overtones.
The second one is called the Benevolent Hypothesis, what you call Space Brothers. Tell
right.
us about that.
Well, you know, that's Adamski. That's really where it started. I mean, we have to go back to 47 again, and this remarkable coincidence. You know, George, I call it a triangulation.
Yeah.
Just think, the UFO phenomenon, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is a UFO, they were a UFO cult, a contact cult, and the Nag Hammadi, which was an expose of the contact cult, all came to light in that fantastic summer.
That's true.
And if we go back to that time, and we go back to the first contactees, like George Adamski and so forth, you'll remember that in the beginning, it was implied that they were space brothers. They were the tall blondes from Venus, and they really had come here neither to interbreed, neither to perform obscure experiments with us or with animals, but to warn us and help us. So you see, the space brothers, or benevolent hypothesis, as I call it, does stand apart from the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which tends to emphasize a sinister program.
Well, nice way to trick people, though. Befriend them first.
Well, there you go. That's very possible that that could be the case, and in that way the two categories would kind of merge. But they're very different in tone. As you know, if you go back and you read that original material, it was kind of euphoric. It was like, wow, we've finally been contacted by someone from outside our world, and they want to help us. They want to warn us about atomic energy. They want to warn us about the pollution of the environment. To tell you the truth, I do find that a little bit suspicious, and I'll tell you why. Because as a matter of fact, in the late 40s and early 50s, when these initial contactees published their books, we were aware of those dangers, and we didn't need someone from outer space to tell us that we had the ability to destroy ourselves.
We needed them to fix it, not to tell us about it.
That's right. And so that makes me a little bit suspicious about the space brother hypothesis.
I think that's a trick.
I do, too, and it hasn't panned out very well. I will point out, by the way, in just looking here at my notes, and want to tell your listeners that if they go to metahistory.org, I have posted this document we're reading from on the site. They're welcome to print it out and look at it and make notes on it or whatever. I noted in Category 2, the Space Brothers Hypothesis, that the earliest prototype of it probably comes from Madame Blavatsky, who founded the Theosophy movement in the late 19th century. And she had a theory. She wrote a lot about Atlantis and Lemuria.
Right.
And she had a theory about these beings she called the Lords of the Flame. And they were Venusians, and they came from the planet Venus at some remote time in the past and planted into the human mind the seed of a higher intelligence or a higher evolution. And that prototype, I'm a mythologist, remember, so I deal with these various myths and stories. That story seems to be, although it's been largely forgotten these days, seems to be the story that seeded or originated the Space Brothers hypothesis.
What do you think of George Adamski's truly dramatic statements about his visitations?
Well, you know, we all scratch our heads over Adamski, and I guess we always will, you know, because he was the first one that came out. My impression of Adamski, and I try to be as fair as I can, because these are all human beings, you know, and they're all witnessing to their experience in some way or another, you know. But my sense of Adamski is he's a little too close to 50 science fiction for me.
Yeah, I used to think he was a little off kilter myself.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look into his background, he used to have a hamburger stand at the Mount Palomar Observatory.
Sure.
And certainly, as he was serving up hamburgers, he was talking to a lot of people about UFO sightings and everything, because that was at the observatory where
yes.
they were watching the sky. And I tend to feel that Adamski really, at the end of the day, boils down to a kind of 50s sci-fi fantasy.
Maybe just a good salesperson.
Maybe so. He certainly was. He certainly was a good salesperson. That's known.
All right. Your next category is the Sumerian file, which, of course, brings in Zachariah Sitchin, right?
Right. Sitchin is the main proponent of that, as you noted. And the Sumerian file contains these rare clay tablets, considered to be the oldest written documents on Earth. And they present what I call the Anunnaki myth. And the Anunnaki, meaning those who descended from heaven to Earth, are the principal characters in Sitchin's hypothesis.
Because he truly believes they're the ones who basically seeded us, genetically altered us, made us.
Indeed. He uses not only the written cuneiform tablets, but he uses what are called these cylinder seal images. They're very tiny images, actually. Some of them are hardly larger than a good-sized postage stamp, but they show some quite remarkable things. I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with Sitchin, and it's quite convincing the way that he describes or explains what he thinks is happening in these cylinder seals. For instance, where you see a little child with a kind of pigtail coming out of its head, out of the back of its head, sitting on the lap of a humanoid-type creature with these laboratory vials standing around.
Yes.
And this, he claims, was Ninhursag, who was the midwife of the Anunnaki people who genetically grafted the Anunnaki genes onto the genes of the people that they already found here. So they didn't bring the human race here. They found, presumably, according to Sitchin, a kind of ape-like race, and they grafted their genes onto this race, and therefore we have these huge brains.
Do the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Nag Hammadi ever make reference to an extra planet in the solar system, as Sitchin presents in his theories about Nibiru?
No, they don't. And I've also tried to be very fair and sober and even-minded in evaluating Sitchin. And I must say that there are two huge holes in this third category of the Sitchin hypothesis. One huge hole is his Nibiru lost planet thesis just doesn't seem to pan out. I mean, maybe you have come across someone.
No, I've interviewed a number of astronomers, John. All of them say that they don't believe there's this extra planet like this in the solar system. However, they do say, you know, it's possible, we just haven't found it yet. And I talk about this elliptical orbit of 3,600 years.
Right.
And I'd love to get better coordinates and maybe get it to these astronomers to see if they can try to pinpoint where it could be. What fascinates me, though, about this theory, number three, is that they are beginning to find other planets now that they claim to be in our solar system, one now beyond Pluto. And, you know, who's to say that, you know, it's not possible that there is one out there?
Well, the problem is that 3,600 years, I agree with you. And what supports the probability that this could be so is the fact that we know there are trans-Plutonian planets, and we know that they would have erratic orbits. And there's also the possibility that this is a comet-like planet. And because that's the way comets behave, they have very elliptical orbits, and they go way, way out, and then they come in, so they have a very long period. The problem is that 3,600 years ago is not that long ago, and there is no record in history of this planet, as far as I know, having appeared in our solar system during that time.
Other than through these Sumerian tablets, right?
Well, I can't read the Sumerian tablets, but what I know of them, I don't find explicit reference to the behavior of this planet. I mean, that's where Sitchin gets a little dodgy for me. He's fantastic on most of his scholarship,
sure,
as you know.
Well, and Michael Heiser punches holes through him, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an incredible theory, and it does make you think.
Well, while we're just taking one last look at him, and before we move on to the next one, I want to point out that I think the Nag Hammadi materials from Egypt have something to say about the Sitchin thesis, because what they say is that, yes, there are these extraterrestrials, these archons, as they're called, but they do not come from an erratic planet. They belong to the part of the planetary system apart from the Earth. They are inherent to our planetary system. So that's a variation on what Sitchin is saying.
Sure. Category 4, biblical ufology.
Right. Biblical ufology is just a term that I use for all the theories that treat the materials of the Old and New Testament and look at the Bible and find in the Bible evidence of extraterrestrial contact. For instance, the visions of Ezekiel is the most cited example. Almost everyone uses this.
And that's a great story.
Right, and it does seem to be describing some kind of technological entity, some kind of craft, some kind of hardware. The encounter with Jacob, who wrestled with an angel, well, was this a UFO abduction? The angel Gabriel, who announced the birth of Jesus to Mary, was this a UFO or an alien intervention? And finally, also, we should throw into that category the experience of Paul at Damascus.
Yes.
Has been widely considered to have been perhaps a close encounter in which Paul actually ran into a luminous being of a non-human kind.
Wasn't he once Saul, a butcher, and then a butcher of people, and then he changed?
Well, he was a bounty hunter, if you want to use the exact term, George.
Really?
He was a bounty hunter for the Romans. And the remarkable thing is that Paul figures very strongly in the Dead Sea Scrolls, because when you read in the existing Bible, in the New Testament, in the Acts, we're told that Paul was sent to Damascus with certain papers, and he was sent as a bounty hunter to go and find a group of people who were causing trouble to the Roman authorities. The group of people that he was actually looking for in Damascus was a cell, an outpost of the Dead Sea sect, because they had a number of outposts in the wilderness, and it is known that they not only had an outpost in the caves by the Dead Sea, but they had a major outpost or cell in Damascus. And to the Romans, if we could put it in context of today, to the Romans, this apocalyptic group in Damascus would have been considered like a terrorist
cell.
Sure,
very dangerous. Stay with us, John. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The next category, John, fascinating, called the mind control hypothesis. Please explain that one.
Well, that gets into the area of a rather different view of the ET UFO phenomena. And that is more of a psychological analysis. Now, probably the first person, the earliest example of the mind-controlled or psychological hypothesis would be the famous psychologist C.G. Jung, who wrote a small booklet on UFOs, I think back in the 50s, in which he proposed that they were, in his language, projections of the collective unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And taking off from Jung, there were then several generations of a couple of generations of writers, but by far the most well-known, and in my opinion, the outstanding example of this category is Jacques Vallée.
Sure, brilliant, yeah. Brilliant person.
Messengers of Deception is absolutely a superb book, and his trilogy as well. So he called, Vallée did not deny the evidence. In fact, as you know, he started working with Alan Hynek He was the protege. Yeah,
he was a hardware believer.
Very right. much so. He was a computer programmer, and so he worked with hardware, and he believed in hardware sightings. But as time went by, and after he went on his own, after working with Hynek, who coined the phrase close encounters, Vallée began to look more and more into the spiritual and psychological dimension, and of course, I believe, came up with a very brilliant analysis. Someone who also belongs in this category is John Keel.
Mr. Mothman, huh?
Right, Mr. Mothman Prophecies. And there's an excellent book called The Demonic Reality by Patrick Harper, which more or less follows the Jungian viewpoint. So this is a very intellectually sophisticated approach to UFOs, and it assumes, as I say in my notes here, that the phenomena is real, but not exactly in the sense that we may think it is real. And what this hypothesis tells us is that if we seek to understand alien entities and UFO phenomena, we must do it through understanding our own minds more deeply.
You know, I have kicked this specific one around for a long time, the mind control mm-hmm. hypothesis. There's a part of me, John, that truly wants to believe that these extraterrestrials and these visitations are physical, that they are indeed coming from another planet, that we are not alone in the solar system, as the old Walter Sullivan, the New York Times science writer of the time, once wrote. I want to believe that. But then there's this other part of me that can believe the theories of Jacques Vallée, that indeed these are manifestations of our mind. Mm-hmm. And because of the way they appear and disappear, and the fact that so many physicists now are beginning to believe in the multiverse and more universes than just one, that's entirely possible now. But the romantic thought of me, right, the UFOs, I want them to be physical. I want aliens to be in the craft looking down at us.
Right, right. But do you want those aliens to be your relatives, and do you want them to live in your mind?
Yeah, exactly. Number six in your category theory list is called visionary theories. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I kind of put this in, you might put the label of New Age on this. This is a kind of a loose category, George, that refers really to...
It's a catch-all.
Channeled materials, such as, the Barbara, what's her name, Barbara Maciniak, the Prism of Lyra, the Only Planet of Choice. This is a vast amount of channeled material that has been brought in by people who claim that they're in contact with beings from the Pleiades and so forth. And the nature of this category is that it doesn't concentrate so much. It claims that the entities, for instance, the Palladians, have hardware, of course, but it doesn't concentrate so much on that. It concentrates more on kind of a vast cosmic story. You know, mm-hmm. there are aliens out there from Orion, and perhaps they're more warlike, and they're fighting with the Pleiadians, who are peace-like, and somehow we've got caught in the crossfire between the two of them. So they're very elaborate scenarios, but the problem with these New Age or visionary theories is that there's very, very little evidence to support them, except the people who are channeling them.
And what do you think of the credibility of the people in this category?
Well, I find it to be, on my credibility meter, down around 2 on a scale of 10, you know, and simply because, Most of us, we're all creatures of imagination, aren't we? We've all seen a lot of science fiction films, and most of us could produce material, if we sat down and tried, could produce material that is similar to these channeled scenarios. So to me, this is the weakest category of the nine.
Are these people charlatans?
You know, that's a very good question. I think it would be harsh to say that. But they may be fooling themselves more than anybody else.
Okay, I know where you're coming from there. Ancient astronauts, category number 7.
Right, well, of course, this is...
one of my favorites.
Von Däniken and all the spin-offs that have been generated by him. And the ancient astronauts theory is basically, you know, a cargo cult interpretation of alien contact. It sort of implies that all ancient religions were a worship of the gear and the hardware mm-hmm. that was left on Earth by extraterrestrials who came and visited and then mysteriously disappeared. So that's, you know, and to a certain extent, as I say it in the introduction to these theories, they overlap. So to a certain extent, you know, Sitchin also plays on the ancient astronaut idea. One of the things about this category is it tends to get very, very weird and tends to develop into what I call kind of crypto-fascism. So, for instance, the idea that Hitler escaped, you know, to South America in a flying saucer. the theory
donated,
the hollow,
donated by aliens, no doubt.
Donated right? by aliens, right. And the hollow earth fantasies and things like that. So this is a pretty mixed bag and gets into some very, very speculative areas and in my opinion, some rather unsound.
Well, and what's so unfortunate about that, too, is because I really believe that there were ancient astronauts that we were visited before. And then when they throw in this hodgepodge of things like Hitler escaping to South America in a saucer, it kills the credibility of the entire theory.
It really does. That is what makes this category so problematical. And as you just pointed out, the latest scientific theories and the latest cosmological models support more and more the notion that we live in a multiverse. The discovery of Earth-like planets is now unfolding at a staggering rate. You know, I read sometime last year, during the time I was writing my book last year, that in 1 week they had discovered 100 Earth-like planets now. And we know that there are billions of stars in the universe capable of having planets like ours and capable of supporting life and supporting other civilizations. And so the evidence points to the high probability that Earth is an outpost for our species that has been visited by other civilizations. And it's really a shame that the crackpot element in the seventh category gets in the way of this more intelligent approach.
Yeah, it is. I keep thinking of the movie Contact, where in the mists of real science and the quest to find out just what was going on and where were these beings sending plans from, you had these people who were way out there, who were on the fringe, you know, when they were demonstrating and screaming and chanting. And they, I think, take away from the real good theories of what could be going on. You know, I think Van Doneken started with a great theory, and then it kind of got a little, as you say, crypto-fascism. It got a little too carried away.
That's right. That's right. It's hard to keep this story on track, though, you know, George, because the myth of contact with another species is such a powerful myth that it impacts the human mind at a very deep level. And it's not always easy to keep our minds and our imaginations disciplined as we investigate this possibility.
In your opinion, are these visitors still coming back, or are they gone now?
Well, my views on the phenomenon have really been greatly affected by my deep immersion in this Nag Hammadi material over the last few years. And I am convinced of two things. First of all, that the human species, through our mind and our imagination, have the capacity to contact other parts of the universe and other dimensions, and that is part of the paranormal, and it is absolutely real, although we have to be disciplined about it. We can't do it in a crazy or reckless way. So I believe that all kinds of contact are possible to us. At the same time, I find a great deal of truth in the Nag Hammadi teachings, and the Nag Hammadi material, which says that there is one particular predatory species that we really must look out for, and that is causing a great deal of trouble in our world.
David Icke would say that they are governmental leaders and officials throughout the planet, and they're able to shapeshift.
Well, that's really taking it very, very far down the line, but I will tell you that in the Nag Hammadi materials, they describe the Archons, that's their name for these entities, as having shape-shifting powers. And that is exactly the word that they use.
Interesting. Number eight, you call shamanic or indigenous?
Right. Shamanic, indigenous evidence. This is a vast category. And basically it covers all of the evidence that comes from traditional sources, like folklore of the American Indians. Most of the American Indian tribes, the Zuni, the Hopis, all speak in almost a routine manner of our connection with other dimensional beings, spiritual entities who are not human, as the Kachinas, for instance. It's been proposed by anthropologist Frank Waters that the Kachinas of the Hopis are actually a type of ET or non-human entity. Among the Aborigines of Australia, among the almost every culture in the world that you look into will give some evidence that we have contact. But again, I must qualify that in most of these cases, the indigenous peoples distinguish between a wide range of entities who are favorable to us and a few isolated entities who are predatory. So this is a vast body of evidence, and I cite some of the books there. Also, Jack Valley's book, Passage to Magonia, is kind of an inventory of a lot of this.
And another classic, too.
Right. One of the interesting examples in this category, George, is the tulpas, as they're called, that we encounter in Tibetan Buddhism. Now, here's a piece of evidence that is actually can be demonstrated today. I mean, there are people living today in Tibet, and there are Tibetan masters who can, it is said, produce a tulpa. And a tulpa is actually like a virtual reality phantom that would appear right in front of you. And we know that the technology of virtual reality is now getting close to being able to do this. I mean, we sort of imagine that, say, people 10 or 20 years from now, instead of watching television, might sit in their room and watch a virtual reality production.
Well, I'm convinced that one day, for example, radio will have a little me on everybody's desk, you know, doing this talk show.
That's right. That's right. A little, an avatar, as they call it.
Yeah.
A virtual reality, a replica of you speaking and appearing, just sitting there on the desk. Well, apparently,
Probably a frightening thought to so many people. Huh?
We can always have a fly swatter on the desk, and you just swat the little thing, and it gets to be annoying, you know. Apparently, there are Tibetan masters who can produce these virtual reality images with their minds.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
Pretty powerful. And there are actual accounts of this. The most famous one, of course, is in the story Magic and Mystery in Tibet by Alexandra David Neal. She was a French woman, a European, who penetrated into Tibet in the beginning of the 20th century. And she tells this hilarious story about how she was studying with a Tibetan master who could produce these tulpas who were so real that a non-observant person couldn't distinguish them from a real human being. And that she produced, with the aid of her master, a tulpa. They were taking a pilgrimage into the depths of Tibet. And this tulpa joined the group and went trekking with them through the mountains. And the hitch was that her master did not tell her how to dissolve the tulpa.
So it
became kind of an annoying hanger-on until she learned the trick about how to reverse the process.
And off it went.
So there's a possibility then, in this category, that some types of alien contact are the result of this this tulpa phenomenon.
What if they're from another dimension or another multiverse?
Well, this is, I think, one of the great frontiers, and I sense that, you're excited about this as well.
Yes.
I think this is one of the great frontiers of science now. You know, we're just reaching a point where science is beginning to admit that we live in a multidimensional universe. And so the next question would be, what is the key to opening the doors to those other dimensions? Now, I believe, and I bring this point up in my book because I deal with the ancient or indigenous wisdom of Europe, that people in ancient times, especially people in the traditions of shamanism, were able to do just that. You know, one way that you could define what is a shaman is it is a person, a man or woman, and there were many women shamans, who is able to pass freely from one dimension to another. One way that this is done is through lucid dreaming.
Sure, or mood-altering mushrooms or things like that.
Or using mushrooms. The use of sacred plants or psychoactive plants, as far as I know, was common to all the great shamanic practices. So it was a tool. It wasn't used for intoxication or fantasy. It was a tool. Another word that comes up is bilocation. A shaman is someone who has mastered the ability to bilocate. And, of course, currently or recently, we've heard a lot about that in the works of Carlos Castaneda. Now, I know many people consider Castaneda to be a fraud, and they say that he invented Don Juan and all of that. And I have no argument with that. But when you look at the actual experiences that he described, they are consistent with traditional shamanic experiences. And Castaneda, as you know, vividly describes bilocation. A shaman is someone, just imagine this, who can be, you know, in two places at once. I mean, if I were an accomplished shaman, I could be here in this house in Spain, and I could be with you in the studio right there, not just on the telephone.
What a gift that would be.
That would be terrific. And this is no fantasy. There is a long-standing record that this is really possible. So if these, I think the exciting thing here, George, is that if we gain an understanding and an acceptance of a multidimensional world, then each and every one of us has to ask ourselves, you know, how can we enter in a sane and safe way into that experience?
Let's open up the phone lines with our guest John Lash when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, imagine a few thousand years ago, you're standing on the desert sands or perhaps on the edge of a mountainside, and you see these craft coming down by the hundreds, probably visiting. What would you do? What would you say? How would you categorize it? Would you think they were gods? Many did. Back in a moment, we'll take your phone calls for the final hour now with our guest, John Lash, on Coast to Coast AM. John, does any of this tie into the Great Flood, Noah's Ark, or anything like that that might have been an extraterrestrial event?
Well, the Anunnaki material that Sitchin uses describes a flood and attributes the cause of the flood to the extraterrestrials. Interesting little anecdote here. If you just read that material on its face value, it says that the Anunnaki gods, the extraterrestrial gods, were irritated by all the noise that human beings were making. And that is the principal reason why they decided that the planet was overpopulated and too noisy, so they decided to precipitate a natural catastrophe.
That's strange.
Now, the flood theme is also a universal myth, and it is also mentioned in the Nag Hammadi text, but not exactly in that same manner.
Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up first of all by going to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Well, hi, George.
Yeah, welcome.
Hi, John. I think you're a brilliant commentator on the Nag Hammadi texts. Just two quick questions, if you would, on your views there. One on the non-biological origins of the Archons. I know in the origin of the world, it seems to me, as I read it, there are seven races of Archons that seem to bioengineer human beings and from their own DNA, and I'm just wondering how you'd maybe square that. And then secondly, in terms of your view on Sophia going into the Earth, do you have a specific reference to that, or why wouldn't Sophia perhaps reside in the universe or in the galaxy and that type of thing?
Excellent questions. Thank you very much. And I see you've been reading the site and looking into these fascinating Nag Hammadi materials. I'll answer the two questions as concisely as I can. The Nag Hammadi materials do not say explicitly that the Archons entities, ET entities, genetically engineered us. It's an inference that you can draw from those texts. So that's something that I leave as an open question. What role did these Archons play in our physical form and our physical evolution? That remains and continues to be an open question. As far as the second point you make, the other listeners should know that in the Nag Hammadi materials, the name Sophia is very important. It's spelled like the woman's name Sophia, but it's pronounced Sophia. It means wisdom. It's a Greek word for wisdom. And Sophia was the name that the Gnostics who wrote the Nag Hammadi material gave to a goddess. And the teachings do say explicitly that this Sophia goddess is embodied in the earth. So when I describe Sophia as the intelligence of the earth, or what we now call Gaia, I'm making a direct equation based on what's in the text.
John, the Nag Hammadi, where are they now?
Well, the Nag Hammadi materials are kept in the museum in Cairo, where they were first interpreted. And I would point out, perhaps, that it's very difficult to read them. There is a standard text called the Nag Hammadi Library in English. It's the only text that's really available, the only translation. And I'm sure many of your listeners have seen it, and some of them may own it. It's very difficult to read these materials because they're a jumble. And that's why I've provided on my website, metahistory.org, a kind of reading plan or reading guide to get through these difficult and jumbled materials.
Okay, thanks. First-time caller line, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
George, nice to talk to you. I've been trying to call for so long. But the questions I have is really two or three, but what the influence on Greek mythology and Norse mythology as far as the extra... I'm choking up. I'm nervous here.
I've always thought the gods from Greek mythology might have been extraterrestrials myself. And I guess you think the same, huh?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Actually, I do. And as far as their influence on great minds of the past, like Einstein or Da Vinci, as far as the grounds that they broke, seems like that maybe they had some help, you know? Especially Da Vinci, because a lot of his work was just something that was never seen before. And it just seems like he had to have some kind of help as far as breaking down the anatomy of the human body, because in that time, opening up the body was just unheard of.
It was taboo, yes, by the church.
Yes, exactly, yes. And as far as like black magic and stuff like that, could all this all be influenced by extraterrestrial activity?
Well, you really open up some vast questions here. And in my work in mythology, I have to look very closely at these. You know, one of my the biggest challenges of being a mythologist is to take a body of mythology, say the Norse mythology that you mentioned,
yes,
and look at the various gods, Thor, Freya, the various gods that are described, and evaluate these entities. And, of course, it's a vast process, but I'll tell you that how I sort them out. I'll tell you in a nutshell how I sort them out. It seems to me that the gods of Greek or Norse mythology will fall into two categories. They will either be expressions of our own psychic world, expressions of human imagination, and therefore projections of our own minds, or they will be, in some cases, independent non-human entities. And it's not always easy to sort them out, but I do find that they fall into those two categories. As to the second part of your question, you know, something that comes up very often in reading the non-commodity materials is the high estimation that the Gnostics made of human intelligence. One of the reasons why the Gnostics rejected the idea that we are genetically engineered by the Archons, as they called them, is because they said, we're already smart enough in the first place. They believed that there is a genius in us that has been implanted in us by creators who are not the extraterrestrial creators, the ET creators, but even higher level, a higher dimension of divine beings. And that the Gnostics taught that those divine beings, whom they called the Aeons, implanted in our species a genius and a capacity to know and learn and invent many things. And so if you accept that we do have our own genius and that it comes to expression in people like Einstein and Da Vinci, then you would have to take a step back and say, well, we should be careful about supposing that we need an alien intelligence to make us smart when we really have an innate capacity to be geniuses in our own right.
Do you believe, John Lash, that we're being visited today?
I believe that the presence of these predatory entities described in the Nag Hammadi text and in the Dead Sea Scrolls is bearing down on us with terrific force today. But I believe that the greatest danger of this intrusion, as I call it, is not through hardware and not through technology. It's through the religious ideologies that are tearing humanity apart at the seams. One of the points that I make in my book, which is coming out this fall, is that...
Title to be determined.
Title to be determined, right. I'm sorry I can't give you the exact title, but we're playing around with that. It's coming out from Chelsea Green, which is a wonderful, well-known publisher of books on the ecology and sustainable living. And one of the key points, I would say the supreme point that I make in my book, is that the Gnostic materials found in Egypt in 1945 contain an explicit warning. And that warning was never more relevant than it is today. They warned that the predatory entities that we need to look out for work on us by planting religious ideologies in our minds. And those religious ideologies are dangerous and delusional, and they have the capacity to tear humanity apart at the seams.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with John Lash on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Linda from Alameda, California.
Hi, Linda.
And I want to thank you both for a fascinating, fascinating program. My question actually stems from something that John, you were mentioning at the bottom of the first hour you were on, something about how we live in our dimension on Earth and that the alien beings who possibly visit us live in our solar system, but in, I'm not sure whether it's another dimension or another universe, but that they can't stay with us. And that's why we don't see evidence of more crashes or what have you. I wondered if you could elaborate more on that, please.
Yes, thank you for that question. Again, this is something that I have learned from an extensive study and reflection on the Nag Hammadi materials. The Gnostics taught very explicitly that the Archons, which they call the alien entities, are a species of a humanoid kind, and that they assume two forms. One is a reptilian-type body, and the other is they described it as an aborted fetus, a premature fetus. Well, as you know, the visitor-type entities of Whitley Strieber, the big bug-eyed creatures, look like an aborted fetus. They look like a prematurely born human being. So these descriptions are explicit in the Nag Hammadi materials. And what they said about these entities was that they live in the solar system. Now, the Earth, they had a very bizarre idea, the Gnostics. They taught that the Earth, the planet Gaia, does not really belong to the solar system that it's in. It's captured in the solar system.
And that's very possible.
Yes, that is very possible. And it is an anomaly because it is the only planet in the solar system of nine planets that has a living atmosphere and has the capacity to support life as we know it. Now, the best analogy I would use to respond to your question is the analogy of deep sea divers. Suppose we were a bunch of flounders that lived on the bottom of the ocean, and every once in a while, these weird entities dropped down to our territory, and they were wearing scuba gear, they were wearing big helmets and clunky uniforms and clunky boots to keep them on the bottom of the sea, but they would never be able to come down and stay very long, would they? Because, in fact, our world, the world of flounders under the sea, is not the world where those entities belong. So the Archon ETs are real physical entities, but they do not belong in our atmosphere, and they can only dodge in and dodge out of it in a very erotic and confusing manner.
How close do you think David Icke is with his thoughts and beliefs of the reptilians that he believes are here now, a lot of them in the position of power?
Well, boy, this is a huge question, and David Icke is certainly someone who needs to be respected. His research, in many respects, as you know, is very, very solid. He's done his homework. I believe that, however, in his reptilian agenda idea, he goes into a kind of psychotic blackout, and it's not consistent with what I understand the reptilians to be doing. He gives them far too much credit. And you have to bear in mind that while Icke is very, very skilled at prying apart the layers of CIA mind control games and so forth, he himself is not invulnerable to those same techniques.
Okay, let's go now next to our east of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yes, my name's Barry. I'm from Harpers Ferry, West Virginia.
Well, welcome to the program, Barry.
I've been listening to your show for quite a while, work nights, so I got plenty of time to listen to your show, and
good
it's great.
You.
I've been listening for 3 or 4 years now. And I'd like to ask John a question here.
Sure. He's all yours.
Okay. I would like to have your ideas on the possibility, due to Earth seeming to go through cataclysms in the past that were somehow related to gods all the time, possibly they could have weather control, as our government's been suspected of having today. And it seems to me like due to the abductions, animal mutilations, and crop circles and everything else, that maybe they're collecting data, genetic information, and materials for a reseeding of the Earth for the next cataclysm that could be coming on 2012.
Wow. Well, that's a very interesting hypothesis in itself. We could create another category for that. I see you've put together some of the evidence from the extraterrestrial theory, and there's a lot of what you say makes a lot of sense. I would suggest, though, that the one thing that handicaps us most in thinking about the things that you're describing here is that we don't know enough yet about the intelligence and behavior of the Earth itself. You know, one of the things that I emphasize in my book is the Gaia hypothesis, which says that the Earth itself is a living entity. It's an intelligent, self-regulating being. The Gnostics called it by the name Sophia. And if we were able to communicate more with the Earth, and if we understood the life of the Earth more, then we would have a way to understand these cataclysms that the Earth goes through. They would, in a sense, be the mutations of Gaia. And then we could compare that information with these other ideas that suggest that the cataclysms are being manipulated or orchestrated externally. So you bring up some really important ideas, and we need to have more of an understanding of the biophysics of the Earth in order to answer the questions that you're considering here.
Is there one thing out there, John, that you are really excited about with all the work you've been doing?
Well, I'm really excited about the message of Gnosticism, the true message, which I think I have extracted from these Nag Hammadi texts, because I believe that no matter whether there are extraterrestrials in the works or whether being manipulated by reptilians or all of that stuff, the most obvious peril to life on the Earth today is warring religious ideologies, a clash of ideologies, and a clash of the Muslim and the Christian belief systems. And the Gnostics warned us 2,000 years ago that this clash was possible, and they connected it very closely with extraterrestrial influences. So that, to me, is very exciting.
All right, stay with us. John Lash and final phone calls in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, make sure you're part of our Coast to Coast program tomorrow night. Yes, it's our Friday into Saturday morning open lines. But the first hour, we're going to talk with a climatologist about weird weather things, cows that fly through the air, all kinds of things. So make sure you're part of the program. And then somewhere in the show, I'm going to be playing my interview with the attorney for the John Teeter time traveler family. And also, as you know, I interviewed John Teeter's mother through the attorney. We don't hear John Teeter's mother's voice, but she did answer the questions through the attorney. So that'll be all on our next Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with John Lash and the rest of your phone calls. John, what's on your plate beyond this upcoming book?
Well, that's hard to say. It was quite an effort to get this book out. I've put 40 years of my life into the research of this book. And actually, I'm kind of standing on a precipice right now. So anybody's guess where I go from here.
Do you travel much?
I travel here in Europe and come to the States. Yeah, and I'll be doing a tour for my book. I come to the States in October and November for a big conference given by the Marian Institute, which sponsors the website. But I don't travel around the States themselves that much.
John, do you find the Europeans have a different outlook about extraterrestrials and UFOs than perhaps here on the Northern American hemisphere?
Yes, they do. Mainstream Europeans are far less aware of it than mainstream Americans. There are books and there are movements in Europe which are very interested in UFOs and ETs, but it remains largely a countercultural phenomenon and is not nearly as widely known and discussed as it is in the States.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. My name is Melanie. I'm calling from Pennsylvania.
Hi, Melanie.
I wanted to tell you, my fiancé served in the military, Marines, from 1980 to 1983. He said in 1981 he was in Lebanon. It was he and about 50 other guys, you know, maybe a couple from another barrack.
Mm-hmm.
He said that a UFO came down. It was about the size of a football field, and there was about six other crafts by it. He passed out.
He passed out?
He passed out. The other guys told him that they were sticking stuff up his nose and their noses. These men decided that they were going to tell their sergeant. He decided he wanted to keep quiet about it. 2 days later, they sent him to back to base, Cherry Point, North Carolina. And then he said the following 2 days, the men in Lebanon, it blew up. And when he was telling me this, I really didn't believe this because he just recently, we've been together, he and I, for about 5 years, and he just told me this about 6 months ago.
Now, when you say it blew up, you're talking about where they were?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember
that. He said that the government did it, and I told him, you know, well, why would he think it? He said because they were all armed with rubber bullets. They weren't under attack. And so what had happened, he's been suffering from headaches. He said ever since that happened, he had headaches. I said, well, did you ever have an MRI done? He said he hasn't. So we took him to the doctor. Here he has an AVM, which is a cluster of blood vessels that became entangled in the brain. And he has a retention cyst behind the right eye and all kind of other problems that's wrong with his nose. So I told him he should open up a claim with the VA. He said, I can't do that. I said, why not? He said, because 3 months after I got out of the military, my apartment was broken into, and my DD form 214 was stolen.
He can get another one.
Well, here's the thing. He said that the doctor said he was born with this. I said, well, look, if you were in the military like that, open up a claim. My dad even told me that. Well, when he tried to open his claim, he got a letter back 3 years later that there's no records of him. He told me he's been trying to get the DD 214 form for about 7-8 years.
Oh,
he's always
weird.
Hitting a brick wall.
Okay, what do you think's going on with him?
I think he's telling the truth. Because
you think all of this has to do with what he saw?
Absolutely. And he told me, he promised me that I'd never say anything, but
he told the wrong
person. You know, but and here's the thing. He told me the only papers, I'm a type of person, I do in fact. He told me that the only person who has record of him being in military is his mother. I called his mother up. I went there.
And she denied being the mother, right?
She handed me, yeah. She handed me papers with him being a combat engineer, an expert shooter, and you know, so I have proof he was actually in the military. He just can't get the DD-4.
Well, let me ask you, John Lash, if you see government disclosure coming soon.
No, I certainly don't. I think we can wait until hell freezes over before we get this government disclosure about anything. It's very obvious that we find ourselves in a situation today with the American government where it lies to its people and keeps many things from people. And there are, as you know, thousands of stories like this. Somebody's hiding something, that's for sure. I would tend to believe this man and believe his experience.
Something happened to him.
Yes, I would. The problem with this in the context of the UFO phenomenon is we do not know if this craft, this football field-sized craft that appeared and what was done to these men was done by ETs or was it done by our own government.
Right. We don't know that at all.
We don't know that. But I would tend to believe the victims.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, hello, George. My name is David. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado.
Hello, David. Welcome.
I wanted to ask your guest if he, what is his take on crop circles as far as the symbology and the geometry that's involved with that? Does he have any information as to where that comes from or what it's all about?
Well, you're out there in Europe, a crop circle country.
We are indeed. It's phenomenal. We have them in Northern Europe, in the Netherlands, but also primarily in England, as you know. I'm so appreciative of this question because it brings up something that really complements the Gnostic and Nag Hammadi teachings. As I mentioned earlier, those teachings tell us that we are endowed, we the human species, are endowed with a dose of divine intelligence. We have a genius in us, and we are smarter and more advanced than the ETs who are trying to intrude upon our minds. This, at least, is what the Nag Hammadi documents say. And the beautiful message of these teachings is that our intelligence, the intelligence of the human species, is intimately connected with the intelligence of the Earth itself, the intelligence of Gaia, or the goddess Sophia, as they called her. Now, when we look at the phenomenon of these crop circles, it's my opinion that they are not created from the sky, for instance, by hovering vehicles who somehow cause the grasses to move or to be compacted. My ex- my view would be that these crop circles are created by the intelligence of the Earth itself. This is the Earth speaking to us, showing us that she is alive, that she is awake, and she's using the language of geometrical and mathematical symbolism, which we ourselves are able to conceive, in order to make a bridge to us. And that bridge, according to the Nag Hammadi teachings, is the most crucial connection for our survival, our connection with the intelligence of the Earth. And I believe the crop circles are drawing us into that connection.
I have believed for eons, John, that this planet is alive. It's an organism by itself, and it tries to heal itself. It tries to fight back. It tries to do whatever it has to do to survive, just like any one of us would do.
Indeed, and in some manner, it wants our communication. We're not just parasites living in the biosphere. I hope not, anyway. We may end up that way, and if we do, we're going to end up destroying ourselves. But if we recognize that our relation to Gaia is not parasitical, but a co-creative relation, then the whole future and the whole picture can change for us.
East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Paula from Texas.
Okay, Paula, take it away.
I was calling to say, based on my personal experiences with these beings, that they are real and they are physical.
Now, how do you know you've had this experience? What's going on?
Well, I've had several experiences, but I will say I haven't had any since 92, or at least that I can remember.
Why do you think it stopped?
I have no idea why it stopped, but I'm glad it did, because it was so terrifying. You know, the reality of it just shattered my whole world of what I thought was real, what I thought was God, and, you know, and also one particular being would treat me with such kindness and always try to calm me down and hold my hand.
What did he look
it's
like?
Crazy.
What did he look
was
like?
Was it a reptilian type? What type of beings were they?
It was the type that had the very, very large eyes and
skinny.
No hair.
Skinny, right. Skinny, big heads.
Right. The right. Whitley Strieber visitor type. Yes.
Yes. And
well, it has been, you know, many people have reported, in addition to terrifying experiences, a certain benevolence and kindliness on the part of these beings. That does not necessarily mean that they ultimately have your well-being in mind. You know, the Nazi doctors could also put on a bedside manner that was very persuasive. But I think that the important thing is that these experiences were very traumatic, and perhaps they showed you something, and perhaps you learned something that you needed to learn from them.
Did the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Nag Hammadi ever talk about how many craft, how many visitors came here?
No, they don't, but it's evident from the Dead Sea Scrolls that the sect that were living in the wilderness there were
right.
Seeing fleets. They were seeing fleets,
fleets of them. Okay.
Yeah.
And I would assume the entire civilization of the time saw these, not just this group?
Well, you know, there's a very close parallel, George, between what was happening in Palestine at the beginning of the Christian era, that is, in the time when Jesus was supposed to have lived, and what's happening there today. And there was a lot of unrest in Palestine because this Jewish sect wanted to overthrow Roman occupation. As I say, it was kind of a Jewish Intifada movement. And accompanying that political and social unrest, there was a tremendous amount of reports of UFO sightings.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on with us. Hi there.
Yes, good morning, George. Good morning, John.
Hi.
Hello.
This is Glenn from Ohio.
Hi, Glenn.
I have an experience when I was a child, a UFO experience through a dream state that I had. And growing up as an adult, my vision, I'm now a multidimensional seer. I constantly see in fourth dimension and fifth dimension every time I walk out my front door, including in my environment around me. As a skeptical person, not in the sense of not believing anything at all, but taking an approach of finding the truth through experience. I have compiled quite a few work of photography and writings that I myself have produced through in the state of multidimensional seeing. And some of the photography work that I've gotten is of ETs and of UFOs. The Archon that you're talking about?
The Archons, yes.
Yes. I believe I have a couple photographs of them. I use different type of mediums to kind of tap into that multidimensional state. And what you were talking about, them coming from a multidimensional multiverse, like you were talking about, George, they are multidimensional. And there are many other entities that are multidimensional.
Are we also multidimensional?
Yes, we are. We are a combination of the light and darkness, that kind of the prism effect of what we see in a three-dimensional way.
Hmm. Can you get us some of these pictures? I'd love to see them.
Oh, yes. I have hundreds and hundreds of pictures.
Email them to me.
I would love to if I had an email address.
It's just george@coasttocoastam.com.
Oh, I would love to.
Simple.
I also have video footage that I use
in
the medium.
My gosh, yeah.
Yes. And what I'm an artist as well, so what I've been trying to do is kind of combine the two as well to produce maybe an art show where I'm at of this multidimensional verse and of kind of projecting the eyes and adjusting the eyes to being able to see in this fourth dimensional way. It's just all a matter of light and dark.
That's important work that you're doing. I just want to emphasize again that both these ancient documents do say that these entities are real, but the Nag Hammadi material adds an important qualification, is that they are real, but their most real effect is in our minds. And so we need the evidence, but we also need to be careful not to be overwhelmed by the evidence.
Wildcard Line, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good.
That's good. I noticed a little while ago your guest was mentioned about the various mind control programs, and I was wondering, does he just know that mind control went on, or does he know about all the specific projects and the details of what went on in a lot of these mind control programs? The reason I ask that is because I myself am a mind control survivor from the Mars Project, and from 1984 to 1986. It was an acronym that stood for Mind Altering Reprogramming Study.
Now, who did this on you?
U.S. Army.
Interesting.
Military intelligence.
Was it a successful test?
Well, from 1984 to 1990, the doctor who ran it was named Dr. Gorman. He had about 300 test subjects. 32 of us survived it. The other guys,
God,
most of them ended up brain fried in mental institutions.
Right. Well, I'm not an expert in this field.
What were they looking for?
They were trying to perfect a no-fear drug. I was told it was LSD-25. Whether there was some other kind of no-fear drug, I don't know. But what I can tell you is the most sadistic psychological torture test you could ever comprehend is what we would be put in. Like, for instance, they would have, say, a log chain tied around the neck of a very rabid, say, Dobermans or Rottweilers, and it was measured out so they knew exactly how far he could go, because the chain was attached to a wall.
Right, right.
And we'd be sitting in a chair, and he'd be stretched out just inches from our face, and we just had to sit there. And they were trying to perfect this no-fear drug. And that was mild compared to some of the other ones. One of the more horrifying
tests. Sounds like an Iraqi prison.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of that. Same thing.
Hey, we've only got about 30 seconds to go, so thank you for your call. I wish we had more time for that one. And, John, I want to thank you for being on the program. Want to wrap it up with a 30-second statement or anything you'd like to say?
I would just like to say that there's a beautiful and liberating message for humanity in these Nag Hammadi teachings, and they point very clearly to the fact that these ETs do exist, and they may be regarded as gods, but beyond them are the true gods. And that's where our connection to the cosmos is to be found.
Very good. John, thank you so much. We've got to get you back on again.
Thank you so much, George. A great pleasure.
Wonderful, wonderful guest. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, special guest Jeremy Oliver, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.